Interim Ag and Natural Resource Committee, August 24th. And thank you for the committee for being here. We were supposed to be on a tour today, but we've moved that to September 8th. And so you're getting an email notice on that if you haven't already. Hopefully you can make the tour. And so we're working out the details on that. We are joined today by Representative Susan Morgan, who's joined this committee because of the implications of what we need to address and the rules on the Department of Forestry. So, Representative Morgan, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to extend my appreciation to you, Representative Smith, for allowing me to join you here today. It's been somewhat of a lengthy time since I've been involved in natural resource policy on the official level, but the issues that we're going to talk about today with the department, I think, clearly cross over between the policy and the budget arena. And so just once again, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to join the committee.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much. I've asked Ted Lawrenson and Marvin Brown, the director of Department of Forestry, and we're joined by Larry Giustina.
Yes.
Did I say that right? A board member from the Department or Board of Forestry. So if you'd like to make your presentation on Rules 3 and 4, that's what we're here about, and we'll proceed. Welcome.
Wow. Thank you, Chair Smith. For the record, I am Marvin Brown, the director of the Department of Forestry, and other members. It's nice to see you. As we understand, we want to talk about forest practices rulemaking, particularly Rule 3 and 4, and perhaps some discussion about the relationship between that and our ability to put the resources out in the field that are necessary to manage those rules.
I might add that the Board of Forestry had postponed making their decision on this until September 6th, and that's to give us time to review and go over this, and that's why Representative Morgan is here. So I wanted to add that, too. So
yes.
Thank you. If you could just address 3 and 4.
Okay.
That would be great.
Good. I thought if it's okay, I'd back up just a little bit since one of our board members are here and make sure everyone understands kind of the role of the Board of Forestry. By statute, they are given the rulemaking authority for the Forest Practices Act. They are the body that sets the administrative rules for the forest practices. There's 7 members of the board. 2 attorneys, actually one of your panel members is recently off the board, but we currently have 2 attorneys, Barbara Craig and Bill Hutchison. We have a rancher and family forest landowner, Chris Heffernan. Diane Snyder runs a not-for-profit economic development agency in Northeast Oregon. Jennifer Philippi, her family runs a sawmill in Southern Oregon. Our chair is Steve Hobbs. He's Associate Dean of the School of Forestry. And Larry Giustina is the president of Giustina Land and Timber, a significant landowner in the state. So a group of folks who come to the question about forest practices and administrative rules with a good perspective about what are landowners impacted by. So just wanted to emphasize that. And I'm going to turn kind of the main discussion over to Ted to talk about the specific rules that you asked us to address today. So
thank you very much.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ted Lawrence, Assistant State Forester. We're going to kind of segue first into the private forest program, and it provides a range of services to Oregon that promote and support landowners, improving forest health, timber, fish, and wildlife habitat, soil and water quality, recreation opportunities, and aesthetics of private forests. This is provided through a mix of information, technical assistance, financial incentives, and regulation. Again, the forest practices rules are only one component of how we accomplish this range of services. Today's topics are to talk about the proposed administrative rules to improve water quality and fish habitat, and then also about the workload and priorities of the department in that context. There are 2 rules. One relates to riparian management above known barriers to fish passage, and the second deals with providing large wood from debris flows and landslides to fish-bearing streams. The proposed rule changes are based upon a number of factors. The first was back in 1999, then Governor Kitzhaber directed the Board of Forestry to pull together a process we call the Forest Practice Advisory Committee to review forest practices rules and make recommendations for improvements to protection of water quality and salmon. That process was informed through work by the independent multidisciplinary science team. Subsequent to the work of the Forest Practice Advisory Committee, the Department of Forestry and DEQ did what we call a sufficiency analysis, which asks the question about how well do the forest practices rules meet water quality standards. And we looked at that from a site perspective and a landscape perspective and a watershed scale perspective in between those two. And also we had a final group we called Eastside Riparian Functions Advisory Committee that looked at some of the same issues of the Forest Practice Advisory Committee, focusing specifically on Eastern Oregon. Out of that work, 18 recommendations were developed. The Board of Forestry has been working on those for quite some time. In many cases, and probably most cases, the Board has chosen to approach implementing those recommendations through either voluntary methods or to continue to work on monitoring that would better establish whether or not there truly is a problem, and if so, to address it at that point in time. These two particular areas are the darker blue, number three and four concepts. And like was mentioned, the board did defer decision on those till September 2006. There are two other concepts, 8 and 12, that are actually relatively more substantive in their potential impact both on water quality and fish habitat and on landowners, and those are still being developed. And again, in the context of workload, it's something the board will have to think about as well in the future. Rule concept 3, it's a fairly simple approach, and it was again a fairly specific recommendation out of the Forest Practice Advisory Committee process, where we're trying to recognize that where there are known artificial barriers that block passage to fish, so the only reason why fish use ends in the stream is a culvert or other artificial barrier, and we've confirmed there are no fish above that barrier, that we would now change the rule to treat that stream as a fish-bearing stream for protection purposes rather than the current process where it's treated as a non-fish-bearing stream. The approach to classifying the stream in terms of the upward extent of fish use would stay the same as current process, but it basically would change. This is the stream flowing downstream this way. You've got a culvert that is known to block fish. We've done a fish presence survey that shows that fish use ends right here, and we've also checked above the culvert to confirm there are no fish above. It would keep the current typing below the culvert, but would change the typing from type non-fish to type F fish up to the first natural barrier, and we have a process that would stay the same to do that. The second part of the rule would also change the process in terms of how we would default if we don't do a survey for fish use and use the interim processes for classifying streams. So the current system or rule, basically for planned operations, we use what we call interim criteria to determine the end of fish use or a survey. And if we can't do a survey, the interim classification applies, but if the landowner has made a request a year in advance of an operation and we don't complete the survey under the current rules, instead of defaulting to the interim criteria, it actually defaults to a type N. And this would change that process to where under the proposal for planned operations, even if we didn't get the survey done in the time requested, the interim criteria would continue to be applied to determine the natural barrier upstream. So that's the second part of the change. The part of the logic for shifting this approach is that, one, most landowners have not made requests for surveys in that timely way in terms of a year before operations. In most cases, we're going out and applying the interim process, and that's been the pattern of practice for quite some time now. Now, that being said, it's also important to recognize that one of the reasons why we did value fish presence surveys as being a general approach to finding and determining the end of fish use, is it does provide important information about culverts that block fish over time. It also provides a baseline with regard to where are fish, so if that changes over time, we could do monitoring and do that kind of assessment. So those were some other values that come out of fish presence surveys. The interim criteria process, again, this stays exactly the same. I think we've had some misunderstanding that there would be a change in how we would define streams upslope of a barrier that's artificial, or where there isn't a barrier and we still don't know what the stream classification is. There are two processes for determining upstream extent of fish use. The first is a physical survey. This is probably done more often than not where the forest, our stewardship forester walks the channel, and based upon the criteria listed in this column, they make a call on where the natural barrier is. We also can do a map analysis process, so if there's any waterfall map marked on a map, or there's a channel steepness greater than 20% on the map that we can calculate using digital elevation models, or there's basin sizes that we calculate, and anything larger than those would be the endpoint. Anything smaller would be the non-fish. So those processes are in place, are currently being used, and have been used since 1994, and under the proposal would continue to be used for determining end of fish use. The second rule concept four, relates to wood from debris flow. From a scientific perspective, what research has found is that large wood that is important for fish habitat in many cases comes very dominantly from upslope sources from debris flows. In steeper terrain in Oregon, as much as 50% of the large wood that is delivered to salmon streams over time appears to come from those kind of sources. So this rule is intended to try and address that particular need and maintain a source of wood from debris flows. The approach taken is to use trees that are already required to be left by statute for wildlife purposes and to direct their placement to areas where we think they're likely to be delivered to fish-bearing streams should a debris flow occur. In this example, to show how it would work, where we have a 40-acre harvest unit, generically would describe as a clear cut, statute requires that two green trees and snags per acre be left in that unit for wildlife purposes. If that unit had a small type N stream that we would then define as debris torrent prone with a high likelihood of delivery to a fish-bearing stream, then we require that within an area 50 foot wide each side of that channel, upstream of the riparian management area for the fish-bearing stream for 500 feet, the landowner would leave those in-unit trees up to the extent that there would be available trees. And going through the example, in some cases, in-unit trees can be counted as part of the leave trees left along fish-bearing streams. So in this case, we're assuming that 20 trees can be counted as in-unit leave trees within the RMA of the fish-bearing stream, which leaves 60 trees left. And the landowner then would be, if it met the definition of the small type debris torrent prone stream, the landowner would be obligated or directed to leave the remaining, or search for the remaining in-unit trees within that area and retain them if they were there. And using the example, if there were more than 60 trees in the search areas, in this example 70, then they would have to only retain 60. If there were only 40 trees, they would only have to retain 40 trees. They'd have the option of retaining the other trees elsewhere. The proposed rule would not require retention of more in-unit harvest leave trees, but it would change the option of the landowner to be fully discretionary about how those trees are placed. It would only apply to that subset of areas where you would have debris torrent prone channels that have a high likelihood of delivery of wood to channels. The rule itself does not speak to the specific approach or guidance in how you would determine those kind of streams and the circumstances specifically in terms of how you'd retain things. We're doing that through guidance. And this particular rule would not be implemented for 1 year after the board adopts it for two reasons: to make sure the guidance is going to be effective and appropriate, and two, to allow landowners to think about where these locations may be and plan their harvest units around them, because one of the impacts retaining trees along small thick end streams, it does change how the harvest unit may be affected in terms of layout and the actual harvesting process. The Oregon Board of Forests addressed these rule concepts at their July meeting and asked us to address three topics, the first being the workload associated with implementing the new rules and how this will be distributed between the department and the board, our Department of Private Landowners, the resources necessary to effectively implement these rules, and a discussion of priority and effect on the services if staff shifts resources to accommodate these new rule concepts. So I'm going to go through these three questions. In terms of the workload associated with implementing these new rules, how this will be distributed between the department and private landowners, and the resources necessary to effectively implement these rules, we're going to try and address those jointly. In terms of the first rule concept, it's likely that we may get more requests for surveys, that people will not want to rely on the interim criteria. That works both ways. On average, the interim criteria tend to find the endpoint of fish use somewhat less than what you'd actually find if you survey. There's a number of reasons for that, but on average that's true. Obviously, there's a range of outcomes that may be differential there that may be positive or negative based upon the landowner's perspective. It would change fish use designations of above artificial barriers. We think there are about 700 sites that we've identified over time. Now, some of those sites have been replaced with fish passage barriers. So that was one of the purposes for going out and looking in the first place, was to let landowners know there were barriers, and particularly landowners are pretty active in the Oregon plan. There's been a very strong effort to replace those sorts of culverts. So at what we think at worst would be something about 700 sites that we would have to change the designations on. I think the total workload to implement both that process of changing the designation, dealing with more surveys and some other workload, would be approximately two positions over the first year and probably a little additional work after that. Would make the point that the workload would be something that would not necessarily be done by our stewardship forces. Some of it would be, and some of it would be done by administrative and other staff.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Dinkfeld.
Thank you. I have a question, Ted. Regarding the surveys, could a private landowner also hire somebody to do a private survey using ODF and ODFW's criteria and then submit that to the department for review?
They can. That's the way it's being most often done now. And in fact, we did a lot. We've done about 6,500 surveys. But at this point in time, the bulk of the survey work is being done either by landowners following the protocol under contract. In some cases, we're doing the work, and in some cases, ODF&W still is doing some work. We also have a cooperative crew under the FIRE program that is contracting with landowners to go out and do work during the survey season. One of the real dilemmas with the survey process, there's a fairly narrow window every year when you can do it. Basically, fish distribution maximizes during the spring spawning period when the water levels are high. And so you've got to get that window. And just one example, in several cases where we actually had gone out and surveyed some streams, found fish in early May, we went back to photograph the channels as an example, and the channels were dry, were grassed over, and you'd never know. In fact, in one case, cattle were grazing over the channel. But those can be very important spawning streams, and the fish will go in there, spawn, in a month's time, the fish will leave. And so you got a very narrow window. And that's in part why the interim approach has somewhat become more effective and efficient, because it's a year-round process as opposed to that pretty narrow window of survey.
Can I just have a follow-up to that?
Yeah.
Ted, if a landowner is interested in replacing a culvert, say, that is a barrier, and they're going to apply to OWEB for funds for cost share, could they use OWEB funds for conducting the survey as well as part of that project?
I'm going to say I don't know. You may well, Representative Dinkfelder, know better than I on this particular case. Most forest landowners that are engaged in the Oregon plan have generally done those sorts of things on their own, under the belief that those funds would be better applied to landowners that would be less capable of doing that kind of work. We have gotten grants from both ODF and WNOWEB in the past to do fish presence survey work generally, and I've appreciated that. Most forest landowners have not requested funding for replacement of culverts either, so they've done that on their own nickel. Part of the hypothesis behind the culvert approach is basically other state law requires that basically makes a prohibited condition to maintain a barrier to fish passage. And so this approach basically says, let's be collaborative about this. It doesn't make sense to rip out a good culvert. They've got a lifespan. Most of these are pretty high up in the system, so let's let the culvert go ahead and amortize out in terms of its value. Let's protect the stream above that point, knowing that when it does get replaced, it'll be replaced with a fish passage culvert. So it was designed to be a collaborative balance, kind of an Oregon plan scenario, and we think it's probably a pretty appropriate approach in terms of policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just a comment, if I might, Madam Chair. I think that with the activities that have taken place in conjunction to the Oregon plan over, I think it's probably been, 6 years now that it's been really active, that there is a really robust history in the program of fixing fish passage issues. And both the small timberland owners and the industrial timberland owners and the cities, I mean, there's been all kinds of partners that have willingly become involved in opening up stream reaches to fish passage. And I think that at issue here is not how robust that program is, because it's my feeling that this isn't going to impact that program in itself. But the issue here is the change in the regulations around the administration of stream reaches that are above those opened up areas, those previous barriers, and how that will be implemented into a new way of being managed. And so I think we need to think about, as we work through this, how to mitigate the changing management needs so that they work for all the people that are involved in the land. And this is going to have impact on soil and water conservation districts and watershed councils and small timberland owners that are what we call the family foresters, and the large and industrial landowners. And where I hope Ted is going with this is a discussion about the shared responsibility that's always been recognized between the landowning community and the conservation community and the department to work with people and make things work on the ground, and how the department is becoming more stretched in their ability to provide those services to the different people that are stakeholders in the discussion. So what I'm hoping here is that we're going to get to a place where we're going to understand that if this program is going to be successfully implemented, we're going to have to make an investment in capacity within the department to provide the expertise that's needed to the landowners.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yeah. Absolutely right.
Yeah. I'm my chocolate, Gordon. He's better looking than I am. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been on some industrial property where they did, fist passage. They fixed the creek, essentially got rid of something. But I also spent a weekend in Bandon at Charlie and Sharon Waterman's home, and they applied for an OWIP grant, and they've taken out several culverts on their property and provided some of their own money and labor, and all the gravel, I think, that they're using here coming off their property. But, if our goal is to have lumber and fish, which I think it is, I don't know exactly where you're going with all this, but I know it's been very effective right there on that property and all over the state of Oregon that I've seen. So I think you're going in the right direction from what I've heard in a few minutes. And I apologize for being late. I was out.
Thank you. That's okay. Welcome.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, and Representative Morgan, if I don't get to your point, which I think we are going to really focus on, you can bump me and I won't whine. In terms of the landowner workload, again, it may put more survey burden on them to some degree, to the extent that they would want to do surveys. I would make the point that there are the two interim criteria methods, but kind of falling in a third pathway on that. When you do the physical survey, when you're actually walking the stream, if you see fish, that counts as a fish presence survey. So it's a subtle point, but if you find fish out of the normal survey season, that counts. But if you don't find fish, unless it's in the actual survey season, it doesn't count, because you can't assume there wouldn't be fish during the dry season, where if you do see fish there, it's probably a pretty good indicator that they're there. So we do use that information. So there is kind of a third pathway. Also, landowners in this context, for the classification above artificial barriers, there are going to be some administrative workload increase, because there will be written plans, because it will become a fish-bearing stream. There will be some protection of RMAs and administration of RMA protection around that. There will be some workload in terms of requesting exemptions, because the rule does allow that if the barrier is not going to be reasonably replaced for appropriate reasons, and again, it may be that it's a dam, it's just not going to be replaced. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense then to treat the stream above there as a fish-bearing stream. So it allows an exemption for legitimate barriers that aren't going to pass fish, and to move forward from that. That doesn't happen very often, but it does provide that.
Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, I apologize. I mean, I've heard this several times, but I'm still, in my own mind, just not quite clear on exactly how this thing's working. If we have currently a type N stream above an artificial barrier, this rule change is going to change that to a type F stream?
It'll change it to a type F up to the first natural barrier.
So a type N is going to be changed to a type F.
That's correct.
Now, to be a type N today, it went through the survey?
It went through the survey. So we have basically three kinds of streams right now. We have streams where we know there's fish use. We have streams where we know there is not fish use. And we have streams that we don't know. And so there are lots of streams out there unknown. And we have those streams marked on our maps. And for the unknown streams, when there is an operation, the process is to then apply the interim criteria during the course of that operation to designate it either as fish or as not fish for the purpose of the operation. But that doesn't definitively result in the fish presence absence survey. We do then have a classification, but it is through the interim process.
So if we have a type N stream above an artificial barrier right now, today, under the existing rules, it's been surveyed, and the owner does not have to go through the written plan and all of that stuff. They can go out and manage it as a type N stream today.
Correct.
Now, under this rule change, it's going to become a type F, with or without a survey. So when the landowner goes to do something out there, they have to go through the written plan and all that stuff.
Correct. And there are other applicable elements that, by becoming a type F stream, for example, they would build a road in that segment, have a stream crossing, they would then have to provide for fish passage in that new crossing as well. So there are other things that come with the classification of type F. And there's about 700 of those situations that we're aware of in Oregon at this point in time.
I guess we go to the notification then. How does the landowner know?
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Sure.
Okay. I'm sure you will later.
Okay. If it was easy, we wouldn't be here.
No.
In terms of the ODF workload, there is the question of notification, and our rule says right now if we change our reclass stream, then we've got to notify. And so part of the workload that we've identified is for those 700 sites, sending out a letter to the landowner saying, you have an artificial barrier, we are in the process, or we have, through the board's action, reclassified your stream, and here's the process for you to get information around what that means to you. And we don't know totally the number of landowners that would be affected. Generally, what we found in our very small case study, there would be one or two landowners. So we probably have from 700 to 1,400 landowners to contact in this case. but they would be then informed of you have a type N, it's being reclassified, and without a fish present survey, which can't be done until fish reoccupy, we're going to have to apply the interim criteria, and here's what we think that means for you and who to contact to get information.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Does the department have any idea the amount of acreage that is involved in this category?
Chair Smith, Representative Morgan, members of the committee, I'm going to give you my opinion. We have limited data. We think there are 700 sites, plus or minus. Again, it's probably more likely minus at this point in time. I think on average there was like 1,900 feet in the case study, which there was only a number of sites that we looked at. So if you're looking at 1,900 feet times 700 sites, I think that ends up with about 200 miles. Yeah, okay. If that's wrong, blame Chris Jarmer. the RMA on those streams is 50 feet, and in many cases the retention would be met with between the 20 and 50 foot width. So, you know, it's not insignificant. The average value, I think, was around $4,000 per 1,000 feet of stream, if I remember rightly. So. Anyways, it's $4,000, I think, for the total 1,900 feet.
It was 3,200 per 1,000 feet was the average.
Okay. And on the positive side, I guess if you look at the cost trade-off where the landowner is not having, I mean, hypothetically, since the culvert is unlawful installation and they don't have to replace it right now, average culvert installation in this particular scenario, probably a small stream, would pass fish would be between $10,000 and $14,000. Again, you'd amortize that over time, but there's some trade-off there. But it's not an insignificant change, and you know, certainly the board weighed that information as they've made their decision here from the board.
Are you through? Or okay, Representative Shapley.
Thank you. But, okay, in the long run, though, isn't it in our best interest to clarify what's fish, what isn't, what you can, what you can't do, to avoid litigation, somebody come in and say, okay, it could be a class N, according to the landowner, somebody come in with their lawyer from Lord knows where and say, no, it's F. Wouldn't this eliminate that possibility and over the long run just clarify what you can do, what you can't do, and then let us move on?
Chair Smith, Representative Shoffler, Members of Finney. Certainly, this is intended to try and move us in that direction, but I think you're right. Hypothetically, the ideal would be to be able to complete fish presence absence surveys on a very comprehensive basis, so you would have that fundamental baseline of fish distribution. There's some real advantages knowing that. There are also some huge costs with getting that. So what we've learned is that the interim criteria are a pretty good proxy for fish distribution. The state of Washington has been struggling with the same basic issue. They went to the effort of trying to put together a fish presence absence model, and I guess we could have told them it wasn't going to work. And the reason why it won't work is because part of fish distribution can be explained by fundamentally the physical habitat characteristics, the amount of water, which can be described through basin size, and stream gradient. But what the wild cards are the physical characteristics, waterfalls, chutes, dry sections, those sorts of things that are you just can't pick up through a model. And as the country, the topography gets relatively steeper, which Oregon has plenty of, those wild cards become the driver in how fish are distributed. So we recognized early on there wasn't going to be a computer model that you could use. Fish presence absence surveys are the best way of knowing you're going to find where fish really are or not. In the absence of that, the interim criteria, particularly the walking the stream, works pretty darn well. It makes some error. On average, it tends to underestimate fish distribution a bit, but it doesn't appear to be a huge bit.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, just to back up, is this in response to what I think I remember the IMST recommendation that we begin treating non-fish-bearing streams in high gradient akin to the way that we have traditionally treated fish-bearing streams?
Chair Smith, Representative Witt, members of the committee, actually this particular recommendation is not.
Okay.
And now the board, the other two rule concepts I talked about that the board's not moved forward with other than some conceptual ideas, get to some of that. And the small type end stream issue in terms of water temperature is going to be a factor in how all this plays out. But part of the hypothesis we had back in 1994 when the protection approach was developed was that we believed, and it is a belief, that basically fish use often occurs up to the point where the stream becomes seasonal, and that to some degree that would automatically take care of the temperature issue of non-fish bearing streams above, because if the fish move out of the seasonal portion of the fish bearing stream, the temperature issue would be relatively mitigated through that process. That was one of the logics for actually getting the fish presence survey done to the point we can actually test that hypothesis. We probably can't do that at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gainfelder?
Ted, answer my question. I had a question about how water quality is water temperature is factored in, because I didn't see it listed in the criteria, so you pretty much answered that.
Representative Roblin?
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit to about the wood debris flows real quickly. Now, that's a change on a number of these streams to leave more wood. And in the Coast Range, every draw, I mean, is coming down fairly quickly, and many of them go right into fish-bearing streams. So that's going to add a number of other acres of timber that can't be harvested in a whole lot of places that we've been harvesting. Is that true?
The approach that we're taking is to identify hopefully a relatively small and high probability set of streams that will deliver wood to fish bearing channels. So while there are a lot of steep channels, we're looking at channels that are pretty darn steep. And again, the criteria is still being worked out, but typically most debris torrent streams and channels occur in slopes that are headwall areas are greater than 65%, and so that there are parts of Oregon where that is fairly common. Lane County, Douglas County, parts of Tillamook County, oh, excuse me, what I meant was Multnomah County. the west side of Multnomah County. but this will end up moving in-unit trees that have to be left and putting them in a specific location, so it will impact a specific area. Again, it's 500 feet long by 50 feet wide on each side of the stream. So it does allocate trees that are otherwise going to be left to a particular spot, and that will impact both aerial extent of which lands may be harvested, also impact how other operation elements of that unit can be applied. So there are cost impacts for two ways, not just in terms of the area impact.
And follow?
Yes.
The area, the 500 by 50, is that where the steepness has to be there? Or, I mean, because most of the time the steep is a little higher, and it creates the fall that's going to slowly move towards the group from much higher than that.
Chair Smith, Representative Roblin, members of the committee, actually the trees are left near where the small type end stream comes together with the fish. It's actually in that immediate vicinity. And so that puts it quite a bit down from where the initiation site occurs. And the belief is, again, these are called rapidly moving landslides, so they move very quickly. They're a slurry material. It usually comes down from a very small initiation site, collects material as they go, and that mass of material becomes the greatest towards the confluence, and we're believing that it'll pick up these retained trees, whether they're either standing or falling over, and then deliver them to the fish-bearing stream in a mass of wood and sediment. That mix of materials is very, very good for fish habitat. And so that's the general prescription. The rule itself also allows landowners to propose some alternate approaches. This is probably more than you want to know. Basically, the statute that requires the statute that allows us to direct the placement of these trees was written in a way that didn't allow us to create other prescriptive or alternative approaches in the rule. So we do have a process where landowners can come to us and say, I have a better way of doing this. That is part of the workload issue here.
Just a comment. I was out on private landowners' forest yesterday with this kind of issue. So I mean, and I just watched, you know, they landslides that some engineers are saying yes, others are saying no, and I mean, it's this whole, I mean, do we take the geotech that comes in from some other place, puts a stamp on it, or and says, no, this isn't this kind, or this is, or do we always defer to our people?
Chair Smith, Representative Blumen, members of the committee, it's a collaborative process, and usually we have very good geotechnical expertise. We work with a lot of consultants and other folks, and usually are able to come to pretty consistent agreement about these sorts of things. There is, how do I put it, the basic philosophy that we approach landslides from is that we're not trying to prevent them. That they're a natural process, they provide important natural functions, and what we want to do is make sure that they, as they occur, that we don't increase how they impact things, or that we increase the rate or the number that may occur in any given time, but they are a natural process. We want to make sure that they then function in a way that's most beneficial to either water quality or fish. That's much different than other states' points of view that might want to believe they could prevent landslides. And this creates some interesting dilemmas, because we have a process here where we're trying to both deliver wood from landslides for fish habitat. We also have a process underway where we're trying to protect homes from debris flows, and then how you might approach those two issues is different. But they're very technical. They require expertise, and that gets to the huge workload issue, or the workload issue around this particular topic.
Representative Morgan.
Well, again, I think I'm going to end up sounding like a broken record here, but the critical piece of this for my district, and I think it's also shared by Representative Ritt and Representative Roblin, and also the chair, that this is going to impact significant areas of timberland because of the slope in our districts. And at issue here, I think, is the complexity of trying to apply the rule in so many different permutations of what's real and what the situation is out on the ground. And just to clearly make the point again that it's going to become imperative to build the capacity within the department to be able to assist landowners with these assessments and keep the activities on the ground moving along at a reasonable pace. And so if we put the rules in place but neglect to give the department the tools that it needs to reasonably implement the rules and work with the landowners, that this process is going to be a big failure.
Yeah. In terms of the particular rule around the woody debris, the workload kind of is split two ways. The private landowners and the department, I'll focus on the department work first. There is the workload that comes with screening where these opportunities might exist, and that comes in two forms. The first is, are you going to have a place where a landslide might initiate? And the second, what's the probability of it delivering material and woods to a fish-bearing stream? And that's a fair amount of work around that. Then communicating the results of the screening to the extent that the screening process misses the target, we have then the process of working with the landowner to try and verify or change what we originally screened, and then there's the issue of, again, trying to achieve compliance, which would be, again, through directing the landowners for placement and working with them in that process. The private landowner's workload, again, in terms of planning unit layout, clearly there's some potential impacts around both those issues. One, knowing where those sites are ahead of time so they can figure out how to lay out their units ahead of time. And then certainly then as you go out to lay out the unit, you may well have to plan how to operate around that number of leave trees that they've got to retain. Again, there's some issues around communication, same sort of issue around verification. If they find that what we screened isn't right, how do they work with us to verify that, and how are we going to do that process? Obviously, there's impacts in terms of the harvesting process and finally reforestation. I think most those latter two issues are something that can be managed well, but there are some definite impacts, and to the extent that you've got additional leaf trees in the unit, that does impact how you might use herbicides and that sort of thing. Okay. Okay. We done. I'll go faster.
Simple question. The 50 feet from the center of the stream, that's not measured up the hill. That's measured 50 feet this way and then like that, right? So the distance actually is quite a bit farther from
500 feet
the center of the
stream. Sure, Smith reference top, but it's actually 50 foot slope distance, so it's measured this way.
From the center up the slope.
It's actually from the bank up the slope of the stream. Yeah. There's one minor exception, but it's not important.
Okay, Representative Burley had a question. I'm going to let you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, back on this slide here. The landowners currently have to leave some trees in these harvest units already, which, if I understand this correctly, is box number two. There were talks about 20 RMA trees, maybe counted as in-unit.
Right.
Those are the ones they have to leave now, right?
No, the tree... let me try and answer your question. They have to leave the in-unit trees that are 2 per acre, of the, and they also have to leave riparian management area trees. In some cases, the trees that they have to leave in the riparian management area can also count as the in-unit trees.
Oh, but...
Yeah.
Okay, so... if I may just...
no, I know. It's confusing.
Okay, so...
to be confused.
Geez, we've got in-unit trees. We've got RMA trees. And now we've got debris flow trees. Okay, so now we got a third type. But if I understand this, the problem is each time we're doing this, we're reducing the landowner's flexibility on where these trees are going to be. Is that correct? We're becoming more regulatory in nature than voluntary compliance.
That, Chair Smith, Representative Burley, members of the committee, you're exactly right. Fundamentally, the impact here is not the number of trees that would have to be retained, but it is to the choice of where those trees can be retained in terms of location, and also to some degree the kind of trees that might have to be left. Because right now, if the landowner has the full unit to pick the trees from, they have to be 11 inches in diameter or bigger. The full unit creates a huge universe to make a selection of trees. You got to pick them from a given area, 50 foot by 50 foot by 500 foot. Your diameter distribution may well be different, so there could be some impact in terms of the size of the trees you might otherwise have to retain. So probably most harvest units, that's not significant, but that is a possibility. So it reduces the flexibility both on where they're going to retain trees as well as which trees they might retain within that area.
Okay. And thank you.
Representative Wilson.
And we have, by doing this, changed the definition of riparian area. I mean, a number of these creeks would not have had a need for a riparian zone that now have a requirement for the debris flow.
Chair Smith, Representative Robin, that's probably fair to say. Way I'd put it is these streams have not, prior to this proposed rule, had a specific regulatory area where they retain trees. Some of the streams in some parts of the state do currently have requirements to leave non-merch trees, so within a RMA. So there's some subtleties there, but generally you're correct.
Proceed.
Okay, we believe that workload analysis would indicate that the total additional workload, which would be fairly constant, would be two positions of FTE, but that would be spread out over a number of positions. Workload associated with implementing these rules and how it would be effectively distributed in the landowner department. we think that probably total, we're looking at around four FTE, and we'll get to kind of what that means. So between the two rules, we've got about four FTE, one of fairly continuous, one in terms of probably a year's worth of work. In terms of the priority and effect on services, which is probably more important, there's a handout here. And if you'd refer to that, it's the original version some of the committee members saw was one page, now up to two pages. But I'll try and make this as brief as possible, which is always challenging for me. The top line really shows the Forest Practices Act, and they're kind of the shaded boxes beginning in 1972 going out to 2005-plus. The real point here is the program's evolved tremendously, but it's been additive. I mean, every time there's something changed in the Forest Practices Act, whether it's statutory or rule-wise, it adds. It's been generally additive. So there's been some hugely substantial changes in how we've implemented that program. Again, just the sense that you need to understand it's additive. One simple example is the debris flow and public safety issue. That was substantially additive in the context of both our regulating forest practices, helping local government deal with trying to address their public safety issues from putting houses in really stupid spots. And that's a huge problem which needs to be picked up by us all because we're not doing a very good job there. And I believe Representative Morgan has seen just briefly one home built on a debris deposit that was deposited this winter and is being built right now in Douglas County. I have to pick on their county. The middle line shows also some of the significant changes in the rules and statutes. But I want to draw your attention to the second page where you get to kind of the box on the far right. And it calls 2006 fire militia. And our program provides a huge amount of support for the fire program. In fact, last night as we sent out a fire team, everybody's packing up and leaving. But I wanted to give you some sense of that. That workload is also huge. And back in the early 90s, we adopted what was called the Incident Command System training certification process. For our people to be qualified to fight fire, they've got to maintain standards of training and also experience. And that probably now is 2 weeks or more per year per FTE of our program folks that is taken out of their normal duties. Then you get to the point of their support of the actual fire militia. 10 of our 30 staff in Salem are on incident management teams or in the incident management team pools. 47 of the 57 field staff are on fire teams. I'd be willing to bet most of them aren't doing forestry assistance and forest practices today. And then a number of those positions also provide local initial attack support. So we've got a whole other set of priority duties that are very hard to quantify, but I wanted to give you some sense of that. The bottom series of lines deals with the forestry assistance portion of the program, and that's been less additive, but it's been highly variable over time as the federal cost share programs have changed. And just kind of put it bluntly, the federal programs have become much more costly to administer in the last 5 years than they historically were. So the amount of process that we've got to go through to implement those programs has increased substantially. The bottom table shows the FTEs counts, and again, currently we have some reduced capacity compared to what we've historically had. But again, wanted to make the point that that reduced capacity probably doesn't reflect all those additive things that have come out in the last 6 years. And again, there's lots of things we want to do that we're not doing. In terms of how we view the world, the program has a number of what we call non-discretionary tasks. And a lot of those are process-oriented. Again, just looking at the notification, handling public complaints, doing enforcement actions, processing existing cost share and grant projects that are already in contract, has some serial spills, the fire program, resource site maps, including stream water protection maps, reviewing proposed plans for alternate practices, reporting other fund mandates, and in a number of our positions, for example, right now are funded by federal beetle funds where they've got to do beetle work. They can't go out and do the general forestry assistance work. And so where we've got other fund mandates for our positions, we've got to do that work. And then smoke management. So those are non-discretionary tasks that we're doing. That probably makes up on average 80% of what our field staff is doing right now. Very clearly, these new rules add to the non-discretionary workload, and particularly in the screening process. But I want to give you some sense of how we go through the screening process. We got to look for. Right now, we're looking at public safety and high landslide hazard locations for dwelling issues, specified resource sites, T&E species, and a whole host of other things, domestic water, fish-bearing streams, scenic highways and scenic rivers, subscribers. There are people that ask for copies of our notifications, written plans, so they can comment on them. These would add to that list of things we've got to screen right up front. So clearly these new rules shift time from discretionary to non-discretionary. And discretionary workload, again, these are not in priority, but I want to make the point that the non-discretionary workload really is the workload that are the kind of work that the landowners want to get.
Representative Schaffer has a question.
My last one.
Okay.
Keep everybody happy.
We'll wave on.
And this is a speculative question, too. What if you didn't do this? I think it may lead to more litigation. I know I was talking to my good friend from Ben here. As far as the future workload due to this, somebody's going to come in and say, well, you're in violation of Measure 37. I'm suing the Forestry Department because you're taking away my property value. I didn't see that up there. And if I missed it, oh, forgive me, but that's going to happen. So what if we do nothing, and what if we do?
Chair, Mr. Representative Schaffer, members of the committee, we're already enjoying the processing of Measure 37 claims. We looked at how these rules might be defended with regard to ballot measure 37, and there are, particularly with the barrier one, some pretty good arguments to why they would be pretty defendable on ballot measure 37. That doesn't mean that people wouldn't bring claims. That wouldn't be a significant workload. It's my opinion is that basically ballot measure 37 specifically includes forest practices, and we're vulnerable to claims across a whole host of our existing rules. Any new rules would clearly be vulnerable to claims equally as well. So it's going to be an issue for sure.
And it already is a workload.
Yeah, it already is a workload. We have about 30 claims we've processed, and we'll probably see more of those in the near future given the timeline of where the claims have to be submitted.
I have a question on Measure 37 claims. Would the harvest plan then be a notification of the rule change? If you make the rule change on September 6th, would that, and then the owner doesn't know about it for 10 years or whatever, comes in for a harvest notification plan, or comes in for his plan, would that be the date of notification?
Chair Smith, that's a legal question I can't answer. To the extent that we'd notify on the fish passage issue, that would probably be a pretty good argument. That would be the time of notification. On the other issues, I think how people would read the time of first application or however it's phrased in the measure, that's something we don't have good sense of how that might work out here.
Well, then a follow-up would be, how will you notify them by letter? You say just letter. Would that be certified? Will that be... How will we know if they received it?
Chair Smith, okay. We probably would want to send them certified, would be my sense of things. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Ginkover,
yeah. Well, just a follow-up to Representative Schaffler's question. Just want to clarify, though, that as far as with Measure 37, not to get too much off tangent, but if there's a nexus with the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act, as far as implementing any rules, it's either protecting a T&E species or looking at water quality issues. And I'm assuming your AG's office or whoever's defending these claims are going to be looking at that, and I think that's an important element to make sure the committee understands.
Chair Smith, representing Bill Myers, the committee. It's very complicated, and we certainly have had dialogue over the specific exemptions under federal programs that are required. regretfully, forest practice is not that simple. And so there's some distance between those. Again, how that distance may be argued is going to, we don't know. I guess the real point is here, in terms of the discretionary workload, these are the kind of things that add value to forest landowners' projects. We're not being able to do much of this anymore. And I guess in terms of probably what this really means, there's kind of two issues to me. One, we're not helping provide that education technical assistance for landowners to do the best job they can for their interest. And we're also not doing the best job we can in terms of the forest practices rules, because hypothetically the best way of applying the forest practices would be through an alternate plan almost all the time, where you have a site-specific approach. And we're becoming much more prescriptive because we don't have the resources to look at the site. We're saying just do it, and landowners are responding that way as well. Again, some examples here. I guess I'll skip through most of these, but I do want to use one example here, just the kind of things that we may seem really simple but are important. This is an example of somebody doing pruning, and pruning could add value in a number of ways. It could also address fire risk issues, you know, making the fire safe home. But and people will see their neighbor doing this and go, that looks really nice, I want to do that to my tree. So they'll buy one of these cute little apparatuses and start doing their own work, and they'll booger up the branch collar and introduce disease and cause the tree to pitch out and cause them all sorts of problems. And if we're there to help them give their options and how they can go about approaching their options, is a win-win. But if we can't do that, there's some unintended consequences, and we're not out there very often. Reforestation is a big issue, and we basically have quit looking at reforestation compliance with areas that are near urban growth boundaries, within urban growth boundaries, and within rural residential zones that are less than 10 acres. And those are highly visible places. They don't add up to a tremendous amount of acres. Again, we do have free-to-grow standards, but the brush issue still remains important. We're not staying ahead of that. Again, some Eastern Oregon examples where we, by getting out ahead of some of the forest health issues, it really helps landowners, and we're really not doing that as much as we would like to be doing. This gets into some of the funding. Again, for the most of our position, 37 FTE, we have the 60-40 general fund harvest tax splits. Other funds fund a number of programs. Like I said, those become specifically dedicated to a task. So where we might have had 50, 60 FTE for forest practices, forestry assistance that were generalists at one time, now we've got fewer generalists and more dedicated folks. It's not bad, but it certainly changes the kind of work we can do. As one example, we have specific folks dedicated to the salmon restoration recovery planning process, and that's important work, but it doesn't provide any assistance to landowners. So, okay, we do have a number of program option packages. Martin, go faster. These give you some sense of what we are proposing to the governor in terms of ways of adding resources without moving back up, and these are restorative, not additive in most cases. The restorative ones are 2, 8. So the big ones are restorative. So that's point. There are some other issues that I won't go into. I guess conclusion: Oregon's investment level really compels choices that affect the program's ability to implement for the Forest Practice Act and support management of private forests. We can no longer say with a level of certainty that we could 10 years ago that we're achieving reforestation, that road maintenance is adequate, and that landowners are getting the resources that they need to do their job as effectively and efficiently as they should be able to do it. Our vision is to be an agency helping landowners achieve the full set of values possible from their forest land and not being simply a regulatory agency. And we've become more and more that, or maybe a process agency. To get there, we need to keep people in the field available to help landowners. And this will have an impact on that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Martin, do you want to add anything to that?
No.
No?
Thank you, Chair. We'll leave it at that and see what other questions you have. So.
Okay. And does Larry want to add anything?
No, I'd be happy to answer any questions,
okay.
too.
Any questions of the committee? Any further questions, Representative Martin? No? Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the Oregon Salmon Plan and the success that we've had with that over the past 5-6 years, and from what I can tell from all the monitoring that's being done, the excellent voluntary compliance with it, why are we going this next step again? I think, you know, this, I kind of asked this a little different way earlier, but I guess I'm trying to figure out why are we going from the good voluntary compliance that we're doing under the Oregon Salmon Plan to this more regulatory prescriptive means of doing this.
Maybe I'll let Ted take a rest for a minute. Chair and Representative Burley, when the FPEC produced its recommendations, it came up with 18 recommendations. And the board, as I've been here for the last 3 years, they've been working on it before that, but the board has really followed the intent of the law that says that unless there is sufficient scientific evidence to say there's a problem, that there's not, the board can't adopt a finding that says we need a new rule. And they've pretty systematically gone through 18 recommendations and found that only 4 of those really meet that test. Only 4 of those really meet the test that there's sufficient data to say there is a problem. And on those 4, they've been wrestling through pretty deliberately, pretty methodically, and I think very collaboratively to say, okay, then we do need to address these as problems, and how can we do that in a way that works for everybody? So the forestry program for Oregon clearly says that, which is the board's strategic plan that they approved in 2003, says we've reached a point where there's kind of diminishing returns on more regulation, and we're going to be very cautious, very careful about adding additional regulation. There are places where it probably is still needed, but we really want to move into voluntary incentive-based kinds of approaches. And I think by winnowing down those 18 recommendations to only 4, they've been pretty good at that chore. I don't know, Larry, if you want to add anything, since you've been on the board longer than I've been state forester. But
I guess my only comment would
say your name for the record.
Excuse me. For the record, Larry Justina from Eugene, Oregon.
Thank you.
Member of the Board of Forestry, Chair and representatives and committee members. Basically, we have been trying to move that direction, but we have had FPAC's recommendations with us for 4-plus years, and we have been trying to go through this. And two of the big issues that continues to jump out, of course, is fish and downwoody debris, or not downwood in the streams. And these are two issues that are before us today. And so the board has been as conscientious in addressing that and taking the landowner's concerns in mind. But at the same time, and part of the reason we postponed this is we wanted a little more input and wanted staff to address the guidance parts of these. And also, we wanted to try and see if there wasn't some way that we could ensure that we have the staff to help those, particularly the small landowners, address these issues in a good, sound way. We are supposed to have 3 more riparian specialists that we've given up over the last 3 or 4 years, and that's been very hard, particularly on the small woodland owners, let alone all woodland owners. We need more geotech information and expertise than we have right now, and that's been very difficult. So we're trying to balance these the best we can. We don't want to be as regulatory. We don't want to be a regulatory agency. We want to be a cooperative agency that works for the benefit of the citizens as well as the forest that we have within the state.
I'm going to follow up, please.
Sure.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Is it possible, and has the board discussed the option perhaps of, because And one of the things that concerns me is, as you pointed out, we've got notification, we've got landowner assistance, we've got geotech, you know, the technical experts we need to help do this stuff. If those resources aren't available, is it possible to delay the implementation of these new rules? Because, you know, what's the purpose of having something like that in place if we're not doing it properly?
Well, I certainly think that's something we're going to discuss again in September.
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, just the one rule itself would not become effective 12 months after the board's adoption, so that's already keyed in there. And again, I would suspect the board would likely want to revisit that based upon the budget process. There are other issues that need to be thought about, and gets to your earlier question. Basically, the board delegated authority under certain programs, and again, ODF&W has the basic authority around fish passage. And if we can't demonstrate an appropriate program around fish passage, they may not delegate that authority to us. So we see that rule, concept three, as being one way of meeting their interests and needs under the statutory framework they've got to operate under and their willingness to delegate authority to the board. Certainly when it comes to stream protection as well, the board's delegated authority to meet water quality standards. And again, we've got to think about what that means, and they're obligated to adopt rules that to the maximum set practical meet water quality standards. And so maintaining that one-stop shopping, maintaining our delegation is important as well. So the board's got to weigh that issue with the voluntary side of things as well.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the presentation. I think that you've done a good job of talking about what the issues are here. I think that the message that I would personally like to deliver to the Board of Forestry is to, first of all, thank you for the deliberations on these issues. I think that these are probably some of the people in the legislative process that have the greatest appreciation for the narrowness of the path that you have to walk to get through these issues. And I think that the thoughtfulness with which the board addresses these issues is much appreciated in this arena. It is, of course, something that has been discussed greatly about the cooperative nature of the regulatory process, as Mr. Brown has talked about, the need to retain that cooperative relationship between the agency and the landowners. And I think that when you look at the history of the department, it's that cooperative relationship that has made it such a successful relationship. The evolution that's taken place in the forest products industry on the ground over the last 20 years in this state has been remarkable, and we can stand up now and be proud of the way that we manage the forest lands in the state to respect the environmental issues that have become so important to us. And so maintaining that cooperative relationship, I think, is a critical piece of the discussion as this issue moves forward. And it has become very clear to me that without adding the additional staffing capacity in the department, that the addition of this new level of rules is going to change that cooperative relationship, and it's going to throw more of the burden onto the landowners, a great many of whom, particularly the small forest land owners, the family forestry folks, are not prepared to take the burden on. They don't have the expertise. They don't have the financial depth to be able to handle the things that are going to be required of them to do this properly and to do it in a way that benefits the environment and also allows them to maintain their businesses in a reasonable kind of a way. So I would respectfully ask the Board of Forestry to very carefully consider not having these rules go into effect until we've stepped up in the legislative arena and funded the positions inside of the agency that are going to make this program successful. And I expect that you're going to continue to have some pretty substantive discussions around this. But I think that one of the things that needs to play a role in the discussions is what this graphic so clearly points out is that we've added regulatory layers over regulatory layers over regulatory layers, and that unless we give the department the capacity to go out and make these things actually work on the land and analyze all the different situations that they reasonably have to apply to, and educate the landowners and the stakeholders in the debate about what's going on here, that the programs are ultimately going to just collapse under their own weight. So I really urge the Board of Forestry to consider not having these rules come into effect until we have built the capacity in the department to continue that cooperative relationship.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. I too thank you for your presentation. It's been good.
Long.
It's a very complex issues, and they take a lot of time, as we can tell. The Board of Forestry has done a wonderful job of examining the issues, and I hope you'll take to heart. We have two more presentations, and then we'll decide what we're going to do as a committee, or if anything. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to call the Oregon Small Woodlands Association up. Thank you for coming, and for the record, please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. With me today is Mike Barnes. He's our state president, and he really is a star of our panel. I know we're running short of time, but I just can't give up the opportunity to thank you personally for the time that you've put into this, to recognize that it's unusual for a legislative committee to reach out to an independent policy board like the Board of Forestry and interact on this level. Also to recognize Representative Morgan for her extra time and duty here today on a policy committee when really her focus is on the fiscal issues. But clearly there's a nexus here that's very important. I'd also like to recognize State Forester Marvin Brown because he has reached out to the small woodland community and heard our concerns and worked with his board. I'd like to recognize Larry Justina for being here and also for the board for choosing not to act on these rules in July and instead give us this opportunity.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, as Christina stated, I'm Mike Bards. I currently serve as the president of the statewide association, Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm here on behalf of myself as well as statewide members of our association. I am a forest landowner in Washington and Yamhill counties. I'm also a consulting forester. I represent family forest landowners from southwest Oregon all the way up to Clatsop County. So I have a wide range of family forest landowners that I touch with. I also serve on the Northwest Oregon Regional Forest Practices Committee and have for since 1990. Have actively participated with the staff and Department of Forestry through the years-long development of these rules as well as rules in the past. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to comment today and for your committee time on this agenda item. Briefly, there are two separate rules before the Board of Forestry, and you've heard a good presentation on both of those. Previous testimony by the Oregon Small Woodlands Association of the Board of Forestry has recorded our comments, and I summarize them. Rule concept number three, ODF does not have a good estimate of the number and location of landowners likely covered by this rule, which leads to an indeterminate financial impact to landowners, and this financial impact may be quite significant. Rule concept number four, the current number of leave trees required by the state is clearly established, and while the proposed rule concept would not change this number, it would shift discretionary authority from the landowner to the department about where to specifically leave these trees in small type-in stream channels, subject to rapidly moving debris torrents. OSWA supports the Board of Forestry's writing guidance for rule number four prior to adoption of the rule. Rule concept number three and four, both rules contemplate a shift of responsibility from the department to landowners for identifying and managing resource sites for the public value. Now, let me state for this committee that while OSWA has previously submitted these comments to the Board of Forestry, OSWA is not opposed in a general nature to the rules and commends the Board for their steady leadership and their development. That being said, OSWA views the department at a tipping point. Credibility of the department and its traditional working relationships with landowners is at a critical juncture. The addition of these and other impending rules, the shift of responsibility from the department to landowners, and the evolution of, from adaptive to potentially prescriptive rules will not be successful without the resources and stewardship forces available to landowners. Now we need to be real. Let me cite just a couple of specific examples from my own experience that might shed some light. Also must state in a previous life I was a member of the Oregon Department of Forestry, so I have some association with the department. Many family landowners do not have the knowledge or the experience to implement all the elements of the Forest Practices Act. And they rely on the expertise of the Oregon Department of Forestry to assist with the variety of these tasks. Let me cite a specific example. These two examples are, I think, very indicative. A landowner whose land has been held by the family since the 1880s, fourth generation. The parents are in poor health, and now the next generation is taking over, but had little knowledge or association with the forest prior to that. The landowner sought some assistance. And believe me, usually the first line of assistance that they seek is the Oregon Department of Forestry. They pick up the phone because where do you find forestry in the phone book? And it's usually the Department of Forestry. So they call them, and it's the service forester, traditionally called the service forester, now called a stewardship forester, who usually responds to those requests and provides that information. In this case, the stewardship forester went on the ground, recognized that this family had a substantial holding of valuable timberland, radically had been harvesting at some level in the 200,000 board feet, if they harvested it all in a year. But that history had gone with the deteriorating health of the parents. So the service forester, the stewardship forester, did some preliminary work and said, "You need some professional help," and pointed them in a direction. I was fortunate enough to become involved with this family. We did some management planning, some sustainability resource planning. And now, to this date, and for the past 3 years, the harvest level has been 1.3 million board feet. Not a small amount, not a trickle. And the family has been brought along, encouraged, still with the Association of the State Forestry Department and Service Forces. Another example, and this one is not uncommon. A new landowner bought a piece of land, put their home on this 40 acres, built a nice house. It was surrounded by what had traditionally been forest land. It was cut over. And they saw there wasn't very many trees. There weren't very many trees on the ground. So, again, what do we do to resolve that issue? They picked up the phone, they called who they normally ended up with, a service forester, a stewardship forester. Plans were made, lands were cleared, trees were planted, now there's a vigorous stand of Douglas fir growing. Those are becoming the exception rather than the rule. Service foresters, stewardship foresters are being compelled to administer things by law, and have less opportunity to share their expertise and to assist landowners. These two rules, although you might consider them to be minor, I'll tell you that most family forest landowners do not have the expertise to put these rules into place. They rely at the first line of defense on the stewardship foresters, on the Oregon Department of Forestry. And unless that assistance is there, the resource protection and the impending addition to harvest levels will not occur. So it's critical. With these trade-offs well articulated, we believe that the board and the legislature are now are able to make informed decisions about forest management in Oregon. OSPWA remains concerned about adopting rules without sufficient resources for on-the-ground implementation, and is committed to building partnerships to increase the department funding and protect implementation of the Forest Practices Act. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Christine. Any questions for them? Comments? Thank you.
Thank you again, Madam Chair.
Thank you very
much. Sincerely.
I'm going to call the Oregon Forest Industries Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Charmer. I work for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. And I'd like to echo Christina's thanks for your involvement and the time that you've spent. Everyone, it's much appreciated. I'd also like to echo her thanks to the department. I think the department deserves a lot of credit here. They've done some good work in pretty tough circumstances underneath the microscope. So I want to just make that point, too. No need to go over the details of the rules. You guys heard a significant amount of detail today, and we really just scratched the surface of the detail of the Forest Practices Act. I kind of wanted to comment that there's a lot of hard work that's gone in on the department staff and landowner staff to get where we are, but it is very complicated. So any change that you do to the rules now kind of ripples through a lot of detail that's underneath the surface. So it's not a simple process, but you know that. What I would like to do real quickly is read the statement that we provided to the Board of Forestry in November of last year on these two rules. That was when the board authorized the department to go to formal rulemaking. So real quickly, and I've got it in my testimony too, rule concept number 3 regarding stream classification above fish barriers has general support among our membership. That's pretty straightforward. Rule concept number 4 regarding debris flow and large woody debris has some technical and policy issues that OFIC members and others have raised with department staff at the Regional Forest Practices Committee meetings. While it appears that there is consensus on the desired outcome, which is the delivery of large wood to streams, there is a disagreement about the best way to reach that outcome. So I'm going to leave it at that and kind of go through the rest of my testimony. That's where we were in November, and it's really where we are today. So not a lot has changed, especially on item number 3, rule concept number 3 on the classification. I do want to make the point, and it was touched on earlier in the questioning of the department staff, OFIC members committed to the Oregon Plan actually in 1995, so we've got an 11-year history with the Oregon Plan, and part of that was to replace these fish blockage culverts. And so at the time, it didn't make much sense to us to request a survey above a known blockage so that we could treat this stream as a type N and then go replace it voluntarily. That just didn't make any sense. So our commitment included essentially not to do that, and so we haven't done that, and it hasn't been an issue for us. And the ongoing work that we've done kind of negates, to a large extent, the effect of rule concept number 3 on our property. I do want to recognize that that's not true across the board, and it's certainly not true for the small woodland owner, and we appreciate that. Now, I just want to make that real clear. Regarding concept number 4, there's been a lot of things that have changed since November, and I wrote in my testimony, the devil really is in the details. When we got into trying to figure out how we were going to make this work, it became very complicated very fast, and from safety issues to land out of production, all the things that we didn't think of first, we thought about after the fact, and so it's become very, very complicated. And I, you know, in our original testimony, we said that we think there are probably more efficient ways to get wood in the stream than to leave trees standing up on a hillside. If you want them in the stream, maybe the best way to do that would be to put them in directly. And so we've tried to explore some other ways to get that done. And whether we'll get there, I don't know. But we have worked collaboratively with the department and appreciate their concerns of our, or their attention to our concerns. As a final note, this has been going on forever. In 1994, the department adopted some new stream rules, and we haven't had a chance to see if they work, and we've been trying to change them ever since. So, I mean, this has been going on forever. And it's not clear to me that anything significantly new is going to emerge in the next couple of weeks or in between now and September 6th. And we feel that it's time for the Board of Forestry to make a decision. I'm not trying to be contrary to somebody saying that we should delay. I'm saying that if they want to make a firm decision to delay, that would be fine with us. But to postpone for another month or another month doesn't seem like the way forward here. We've got a lot of information. Maybe it's not enough to make a rule change. Maybe it is. I think that's why they pay the Board of Forestry members the big dollars to do that. So thanks for your time. I'll let Jake introduce himself, and thanks, and answer any questions after he's finished.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jake Gibbs, a forester with Lone Rock Timber from Roseburg, Oregon. And I will more or less read my testimony that I got to you that sums up, I think, all the thoughts I can share with you. But I've been involved with I've been following Rule Concepts 3 and 4 since 2005, have provided comments regularly to the department and the board as part of their rule development process. I have supported Rule Concept 3 and have on public record that's the understanding that it would change stream classifications and subsequent increased protection measures. As Chris alluded, Lone Rock has been a strong supporter of the Oregon plan, and this is a matter of a normal course of business to change fish barriers and manage those streams. For Rule Concept 4, I have commented in opposition to the rule language in Rule Concept 4. But while in opposition to the rule language, support the objective of the rule and have suggested the concept be proposed as a voluntary measure. The board and department have respectfully disagreed with my opinion and appear ready to approve the proposed rule language. The board has directed the department to expedite the development of guidance language, working with the stakeholders in this process. I've been contacted by the department to participate in this guidance language development, and I'm looking forward to working with them on that. And subsequently, I am meeting with, I think, the entire geotech staff next week to go out and start working on this. So it is real. The commitment from the department is there, and I'm very appreciative of that, and we are going to be working at the development of how this is going to work on the ground. It is very complicated, and we're all recognizing that. The July board meeting, the board indicated support for the rule and the proposed rule language, but expressed concern at the impact these additional rules would have on department staff. The board appeared concerned about the potential conflict between an increased workload on stewardship foresters, increased rule complexity to landowners, and the board's desire to encourage more active management in these riparian areas. The board has asked for a report outlining how the department's going to do that. You guys saw a great presentation of the existing workload and then how this is going to add to it. So I think it's now getting even more concrete. The department's prepared to show the board this is what they have to do, this is what they're going to have to do on top of it. What's become apparent to me is that some financial realities exist for the department, the board, and ultimately for the legislature to deal with these issues. Increased activities that benefit fish are a priority of the state. Forest management changes have been identified to achieve that objective. Methods for achieving that objective have been developed and are ready to be implemented via additional forest practice rules and regulations. If these proposed rules are to be implemented and the objective of improved conditions for fish achieved, the Department of Forestry will need to concentrate efforts educating staff and landowners on these new rules. Time and energy will be required in developing and ground-truthing guidance language. I'm taking three staff members' time, and I don't know who all they're bringing down to go out and do this in the middle of fire season.
Shame on you.
Well, we got to get it done by September 6th. So, but that's what it takes, and I'm grateful for that. But it takes time to go out in the woods and do this. But there's limited people to do that. Monitoring, which hasn't been discussed, implemented projects needs to occur to evaluate effectiveness and make modifications. We aren't really certain if this is going to achieve the objectives we're trying to do, and we haven't even talked about how we're going to measure if these are actually doing what we want. We've talked about, as Chris mentioned, if you want wood in the creek, we can get it there. There's lots of ways of doing it, but there's lots of ways of doing it. This is one. These rules are just one of those methods. But we monitoring is real, and if we're going to have real rules, then we need to be that are effective. Then we need to know if they're working. Again, that takes resources either the department doesn't currently have or reallocate existing resources away from needed responsibilities. While I was not supportive of Rule Concept 4, I acknowledge the rule process was followed and the guidance will be developed working with stakeholders. I've been reassured over and over that that's how this is going to proceed. I am ready for a decision from the board on these concepts at the September meeting. I would echo Chris's thoughts. We need some clear direction how this is going to go. Representative Morgan has made some suggestions that I think would be very helpful to stakeholders and the board, but those are great suggestions. If the board proceeds with rulemaking, it is my hope that they recognize additional workload on staff and landowners to successfully implement on the ground. So thank you very much for your interest in this issue, and I'll gladly answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Jay and Chris. Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I don't get enough opportunities to brag about my constituents. Jake is not actually one of my constituents. He's one of Representative Hannah's constituents. Mm-hmm. But Lone Rock Timber is a longtime timber management company in Douglas County. I think they're right now searching for the third generation of the family to move in to start managing. And Lone Rock, over the course of it, the Oregon Plan has been intrinsically involved in it. They've received awards on the state level and the national level for the work that they've done for habitat enhancement and water quality enhancement. Jake is employed by the company full-time and works on nothing but those issues for the company. They have been extremely active and productive partners in the Watershed Council in Douglas County. And we have one of the most productive and best organized and broadly represented from stakeholders' perspective watershed councils in the state. So I would just like to thank Jake for another day of your time to come up here and work on these issues, and just recognize that the company that you work for is doing a lot of great things for habitat restoration and water quality in the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pretty nice. Representative Shoffley?
I agree with what you're saying and what Representative Morgan about getting the technical assistance out there, because these rules are maddening to a layman like me. Uh-huh. I was on an OFIC tour earlier this summer. My daughter and I went on it, and we were at a tree farmer's house, a small woodland owner. Forgive me for not remembering their name, but they grow utility poles. And these poles, they're really, it's $1,000 every 10 feet. They had to cut up 5 feet off just to get the thing out of where they were, because it couldn't fit on the truck. But even to get it to there, they had to excavate. They had to build a little road to get there, and they had to cut a tree down to do that. And the forester came out and was upset because he wanted them to fell it that way, and they fell it this way. Anyway, but looking at it on the ground, you're going, why? What difference? And be honest with you, it doesn't make any difference. It makes zero difference. But I agree with the representative. We need to make sure that I don't want anyone in violation of the law just because we didn't fund the forestry department to make sure people do comply. Because every woodland owner out there in the state of Oregon wants salmon to thrive and wants water quality. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that that's accurate. But they also need to make a living. And my concern here is if we don't do anything, and I appreciate the reduction of productive property, land, if we do this, as far as being able to log on it or not. But there's folks out there that don't want to just reduce logging. They want to eliminate it. And if we don't do anything, they're going to get their lawyers, and they're going to go into court, and they're going to make it more difficult. So somewhere along the line, and I appreciate what you're saying, too, about let's make some decision. I mean, I come into these committee hearings thinking I got to square to where I'm at on this, and the next thing I know, I listen to everybody, and I go, I don't know where the hell I am on it. But I definitely agree with somehow either say we're not going to either make a decision or say we're going to wait till after the legislative session to see where our funding is for staffing, because it's just maddening for me. It's vexing, I love that term, for me to sit here. It's an absurdity sometimes, the things we we impose on people. This guy's just put this tree down that way, and the guy came out and said, no, you should have went it that way.
I want to clarify for you that the rule number four, I think, was going to be implemented if they decided 12 months from now and they'd revisit it after the legislation left. So maybe that addressed that issue. Representative Burley had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gibbs, you mentioned several times in your testimony the guidance language that's going to be developed here cooperatively between the department and landowners or stakeholders. What's the guidance? What's this going to look like? I mean, give us some sense of what this guidance language is going to look like.
It's the proposed guidance that we've seen looks very similar, and I will defer to the department if I get off on you know incorrect, but looks very similar to the same standards that are used in the high landslide hazard criteria, how to determine where that is. We have not, because of the limited staff that's been available from the department, seen maps that I can quantify exactly where this is going to be on the landscape. And so I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. It came out, I guess, to answer the question. It came out saying it was very, the first blush, it was very similar to the high landslide hazard criteria based on slope and slope and terrain and basically confinement. And we raised questions with that as myself and other fourth landowners. That was too conservative. It was too big of a piece of the landscape. If the objective here was to make landslides, it was not steep enough. And so that's where the meeting next week is, okay, they heard us. Let's go out on the ground and try to figure out what might be a better tool to measure.
So is the purpose, if I may follow up, please, is the purpose then of the guidance language to help identify where these sections of stream are going to be, or might it also include things like, you know, physically placing large woody debris in the stream if we're deficient?
And yes.
Both of those?
Both of those is my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern, and I was happy to hear what you had to say about this issue, is that, and just to answer, the issue is, do we want woody debris in the streams? And do we recognize landslides are going to happen? I mean, that happens in our part of the country regardless of whether we plan it, and oftentimes in places we didn't anticipate it because of the underlying structure of the ground. I every once in a while think that when we try to make these plans that we're going to anticipate where the landscape's going to happen, we're going to leave the trees, we may miss the place where it really happens. And the last big flooding we had, you know, those 100-year storms in the 90s, put a lot of woody debris in the streams, and we hadn't had any of these restrictions. So it found the wood and put them in the streams when the storm events happened. And so, you know, I guess what I, and I haven't been listening to all the forest stuff, but it makes sense to me that if we want wood in the streams that we took out in the 60s and 70s, then we need to put it back in. And I know landowners that would say, tell me where you want the log and I'll drop it there for you, and we'll put a bunch of wood in the stream and we'll have it right now instead of waiting for the next 50-year event. And I guess we need to have, from my perspective, I would love to see some criteria that says if this is working or not working, and a timeline to look at it, and is it doing what it's supposed to do in this period of time? And if it's not doing it, then let's do something that makes more sense if they're going to pass the plan. And that's, I guess, my comment.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Sure.
Representative Roland, you're absolutely right. It occurs to me that if you are required to leave those trees above a stretch that's completely full of large wood, an additional wood wouldn't be very productive, but you were willing to put it in another stream segment that had little or none, then you should be allowed to do that. And that's the flexibility that we're trying to search for in the guidance. But the rule is written in a pretty prescriptive way, and the guidance is limited on how it can interpret that rule.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the struggle that we're having, because you're absolutely right. I mean, we can do a lot of good in some places by doing some things and absolutely nothing in others. So.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Over to Representative
Shaw. That's great. Did it fall in the right spot?
He probably threw it. Well, committee, we've come to the part where we have to make a decision on what we want to do as a committee, if we want to interact with the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry. So I would be open to any comments or suggestions, and
Madam Chair, I'm a, you know, not really a member of the committee, but I would ask the committee to consider communicating with the Board of Forestry and urging them to consider perhaps adopting the rules but not implementing them, not having them go into effect until the legislature has funded the positions that are necessary inside the department to see this program through successfully.
Thank you. Any comments on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I absolutely support funding these positions and certainly hope that we're able to find that funding next session. I would like to say, though, that the Department of Forestry isn't the only department that faces these challenges, and there's other departments. I work very closely with many of the other agencies, the Department of Environmental Quality, Division of State Land, that have similar challenges. I think we need to recognize that there's landowners all over the state, not just forestry landowners, that have faced similar challenges. So I would like to say that I think an important role that the state does play is providing technical assistance, not just to implement the Forest Practices Act, but clean water, TMDLs for our wetland fill permit. And I will say that I work with landowners all over the state that would support more technical assistance, not just for implementing the Forest Practices Act. So I certainly hope that we can keep that in mind as we look at budgets for other state agencies as well, but certainly support that. I have worked very closely with many of the Forest Practices Act foresters. I think they play a very important role in helping educate, provide technical assistance to private landowners, and I hope we can continue to fund those programs.
Thank you. Any Representative Rip?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to see the rule implemented. I understand that there are some very practical considerations that come to bear here. But one statement that I would like to make is that the scientific community, in essence, did an audit report on the state of Oregon's forest management, the IMST report. One of the recommendations that they made is that we move towards we move towards managing non-fish-bearing streams akin to the manner in which we manage fish-bearing streams. As I say, that recommendation has been out there now for the better part of a decade. One of the reasons that we continue to enjoy a robust forest products industry in this state is because we've been able to manage our industry at the very best level any place in the world. We continue to enjoy the public's permission to carry out this industry. The audit that IMST did on this suggests that we can do a little better, particularly in high gradient streams, and that we need to be moving towards these recommendations. And I think that we need to make a decision at some point that we are, in fact, going to move forward and we are going to commit ourselves to continuing to be the best managed forest any place in the United States. I am not unsympathetic with the realistic concerns, particularly of small forest landowners, that they need the technical guidance and assistance of the department to be able to carry those rules out. That's why I think Representative Morgan's suggestion may be a very good way to go in this instance. But I do also want to comment that it's not simply a matter of placing sticks and cricks, but also there are considerations of stream flow. There are considerations of temperature and a whole lot of other things that come to play here. So a very complex situation, but I think perhaps Representative Morgan has found the middle ground here.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the comments. Representative Dinkfelder?
I apologize because I will be remiss if I didn't, first of all, thank the Board of Forestry for their hard work, and I know it's not easy balancing all the different interests. I just want to be clear that and to follow up on my colleague's comments, I don't support delaying implementation of the rule. I think you've been discussing this for a long time now, and it seems like you've gone as far as you can, reaching consensus to some extent, but I think it's important that we have the tools in place and the assistance to move forward. So I don't know if we're making a formal recommendation about the timing. It seems to me like you've been discussing this for many years. You already have support. Very pleased to see the, as far as the fish-bearing streams, for somebody who's worked a lot on removing fish barriers with forest landowners, and I do commend many of private forest landowners do an excellent job at taking that on their own. I think we do need to move forward, though, in a timely manner, and then obviously when we meet in January, we'll be looking very closely at the budgets to help implement, make sure there's technical assistance for those rules. So I just wanted to follow up on my colleague's comments on that.
Thank you, Representative. Anybody else? Any other comments? I think what we'll do then, we have several proposals. Representative Morgan, would you be willing to go before the Board of Forestry on the September 6th meeting and just make your presentation?
I'd be honored to do that.
That would be great, and I'd be willing to do that too with the comments taken in effect from the committee. And just we'll just do that. We'll just give them our recommendations and testify on behalf. And anybody else wants to sign the letter, I'll pass it around before we do it. So I think that will work. Thank you very much for all your hard work and effort and your testimony today. Thank you. Right. I don't need to. Nope. Okay. We're going to meet the new director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Virgil Moore, and with him is Ron Anglin.
Yeah, Susan, thanks.
Would you like to come forward? And
give her just a breather. So
we'll just take a quick stand at ease.
Yes, there's a lot of commotion. So. Don't leave. Ted, part of the problem. You can take your computer if you want to.
Oh, it's
our computer.
Into informational meeting. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome, Virgil Moore, the new director, and Ron Anglin. Thank you for coming to our committee, and we would love to hear your presentation. Any comments? How do you like Oregon?
I like Oregon a lot. Thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives and committee members. It's nice to be here. It's my privilege to have the opportunity to serve the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in the state of Oregon as the director. I'm starting or well into my fourth week, so it's been a great 4 weeks getting to know the state and the people and get around.
Technical stuff here, so for the record, you have to say your name.
Okay. Virgil Moore, director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really have no prepared materials per se. It's an opportunity for us to have a dialogue on any issues. I can start out with a couple of items that have, in discussions with the Fish and Wildlife Commission, that we're going to be focusing on in Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, some of the areas that I believe are important. That we will need legislative help with as we work together to try to do some things. Areas that we're going to focus on are going to be continuing the funding and fiscal responsibility of the agency. As you're aware, there will not be a request for a fee increase this session. We will be presenting basically a maintenance of current operations budget that will be coming forward to you, and that will give us an opportunity as we go through the relevant committees and to discuss with legislators the needs of the agency in the future as we move forward. Some of the items that I've become aware of, and these are not different among many of the states, is we have a declining hunter population. It's a very slow glide with a declining population, much on the same as the mortality rate of the aging population of hunters. We're not recruiting new hunters into the population at a rate sufficient to offset that decline, even with the population growth that Oregon has. This is true in most states, even in many of the western states. Anglers are static and have been over the last 20 years. There was a large spike in the 70s and 80s in Oregon, but we've maintained a lot of this type of changes, but by and large the angling population has not grown in this state, even with the increases. I paint that picture for you primarily because that means an agency that persists on user fees is going to have to either increase those user fees at some point in time to maintain services, or they're going to have to find other revenue sources, or they're going to have to look strategically at reducing services. And we're going to be dealing with that over the next year or so before we bring bots forward on how to be fiscally responsible in the agency and meet the public's expectations. So I'll be focusing on that a lot. And we'll begin some dialogue, I think, in this upcoming session on those issues.
Yes, Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to interrupt, but...
No, it's fine.
When, as you said, a department that lives off of fees like that can either increase fees or cut services. What about increasing the number of participants? And, you know, I'm a little curious strategically what the state's thinking about doing as far as increasing. You know, we've got this decline in number of, especially hunting tags that are being sold.
Right.
What strategically is the department thinking about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we're going to be looking at some aggressive recruitment retention work. We're going to look at some marketing, business marketing strategies. These are being looked at aggressively in the United States now among many other states. There's some pilot programs going on in a number of states. I'm very familiar with those. I've been part of a working group for the last 8 years nationally working on at least angler recruitment retention. The angling tackle industry, the American Sport Fishing Association, and others have been very concerned about the decline in angling participation nationally. They currently pay a manufacturing tax of 10% on tackle, and that 10% goes into the federal aid and fish restoration, much like we get for the federal aid and wildlife restoration, the tax on hunting equipment and ammunition. And they are concerned that the states aren't doing enough, and as their share of getting that money comes back to the states to recruit and do retention. There has been an effort to hire professional marketing folks to assist the states in doing that, and the strategies are out there and just need to be implemented. They work. We don't know how well they're going to work in different demographic areas such as Oregon, but we're going to be moving in the direction of doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rogan.
Along that line, in Idaho, yes. They did the family angling kind of issues where you had the no size limit in certain designed areas so you get kids out there with poles. Are we going to look at some of those kinds of things from the department standpoint, or you want us to look at some of those kinds of things? As I was impressed with a number of the things that were done recently.
Madam Chair, Representative Rowland, yes.
Okay.
Okay. And I can elaborate to you at some point, but the answer to that is very definitely we're going to be looking at family fishing. The correct answer to that is we know the main reason people don't fish. Right now, you think about regulation complexity, and that's really not it. It's really time.
It is.
Most of our families are saying they don't have time, and what that really means, they're choosing not to use their time on fishing activities.
Mm.
Hunting's a little different. What we need to do is find out what those families need to choose to use their time on a family-based wildlife recreation activity that includes fishing or hunting. And we're beginning to focus in on those, particularly in urban populations. It's going to require development of urban centers, urban fisheries, bicycle fisheries, family-friendly rules that are no-brainer. They can go there, have a picnic, the kids can go fishing with mom and dad. We remove as many of the barriers as we can, and we find those areas that we can do that from a fish management standpoint that's safe from a conservation management standpoint.
Good. Great. Representative Shoffer?
Thank you. I have to confess here that I don't go fishing enough with my daughter, but I know this much. She wants to go fishing, and that's all I care about. But that we have a day or two, I think, in this state where you can go fishing without a license, and I think that's a great way, because if you get a child to go out with their parent and go fishing and they catch anything, they're going to think it's the most incredible thing in the world. I mean, I'm hooked on it, too. But there's a problem that I've heard that's come to me is people from the metropolitan area will go out, park in a federal parking lot, and they don't have a permit to park there on the free fishing day, and then they get a ticket. Now, I may take an act of Congress, but if we could get it so on the free fishing day, the people from... And then they go home and they hear Dad freaking out because he doesn't want to pay a fine. Somehow, if you could coordinate it to where they don't need a permit to park there on that day because they're fishing, I think that would go a long way, because I don't think we can afford to discourage anybody from being introduced to fishing in my
life. Good luck.
I know, but I think we look for areas. We're looking for barriers that are in the way, ideas that can be changed to encourage people to go fishing. You get that kid out there to catch, and if they catch a nice fish, you really got them hooked. So, forgive me the pun. But.
Madam Chair, Representative, real quick. I have, next week, I'm going with Mike Carrier from the Governor's Office for a overnight retreat at Silver Falls with the Forest Service and BLM leadership from the state.
Mm-hmm.
I've got that down. We'll ask that question.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Representative Burley.
Thank you. Representative Shoffler just made me think, the angling day, I agree, that's a big thing, but I've also had the pleasure of participating with my kids on the hunting days, too. And I want to encourage you that no matter what, you continue that, if not enhance that program. It was just an outstanding opportunity with my kids and a real quality time, and I really thank the department and encourage you to continue on that.
And, Chair, I saw a bumper sticker in Alaska, and it said, "Don't hunt for your children, hunt with them."
Oh.
That was pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I may. You're absolutely correct. The research is abundantly clear now that mentored hunting and the ability to focus on our youth when you take them in the field, whether it's hunting and fishing or any activity, is how we get them literally hooked on fishing or involved in participative wildlife-based recreation. One of the things you're going to see us likely come forward with the help of the sportsmen and probably the Hunters Association is a discussion of whether we should lower the age of hunting. Many of the states have done this. The research is clear that most hunters recruited at the age of 8 to 10 years old. That's when they began going in the field with their parents or grandparents, their uncles, their aunts, mm-hmm. to become associated with the hunting heritage that we have. I myself am a very classic example of that in an agricultural setting, being able to get out at age 8 and 9, getting my first firearm when I was 9 years old, never allowed to use it in the field alone. And these opportunities that Oregon has developed are phenomenal tools for that. We just need to expand them and make them more abundant. If we don't catch these kids for this kind of opportunity, they go through that window into an older age where time becomes much more valuable to them as well as their families. And looking at how hunting and to a lesser degree fishing, but especially hunting, is passed on, it's done at that earlier age. And we need to have a discussion of whether or not that's socially acceptable to begin doing that.
That's food for thought.
It is.
So you're suggesting 10-year-olds have guns?
I'm suggesting that under adult supervision, the kinds of children-only fishing days, youth mentoring days, where the parent does not carry a firearm, or the adult that's supervising, doesn't have to be the parent, that does not carry the firearm, can be in the field with a child that is carrying a firearm. Okay. And the statistics are very clear that that turns to be very safe because the adult is focused on that child. They don't carry a firearm in the field themselves. They allow that child to carry a firearm, and they're totally under supervision and direction. So it's kind of a student permit approach, right, to mentoring them into safe and ethical hunting.
Interesting. Go
ahead.
Anyway, we got, and that's what I wanted to have was the opportunity to have some conversations with you and get some of your input. Other areas we're going to be jumping into is our information and education and communications and public outreach. You'll see that my background has a little bit of education background in it. I used to be a high school teacher. My undergraduate degree is in education biology. And while I have had a long professional career in the fish and wildlife management arena, wildlife education and wildlife-based education that we can use to bring our children up to speed in both the schools and adult education, continuing education opportunities need to be focused on. We have the traditional hunting education, the hunter safety courses. Those are required by statute that any 12-year-old has to have those. That's a mandate and a mission-critical activity of the agency. But beyond that, we have a need for aquatic education, the Project Wild conservation-based education curriculums that are available to school teachers that use fish and wildlife and conservation as a core for reading and math and spelling and other things like that is a well-developed program that best exists in partnership with the Fish and Wildlife Management Agency. I'll be trying to develop that in the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and partnering with the education community to further increase the awareness. Oregon has a rich history of conservation activities here. I think we can further enhance that with a school-based, fish and wildlife-based education program that's out there. We're working a lot on getting all the staff positions filled. It's been a while, and as Ron will attest, there's an awful lot of folks in there that either have interim, temporary, or acting titles on their names simply because a lot of positions have been left unfilled, and I'll be working very quickly to try to get those done in the next few months. I'll be focusing on marine resources, getting to know those, getting up to speed. I have a tour next week, and looking at the needs of the commercial fishing industry, particularly with some of the difficulties they're having right now because of the Klamath, and getting up to speed. I just spent 3 days in Portland at the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission meeting, and there were a number of discussions and actions that came out of there with California that will hopefully continue to pursue and get the funding we need for the disaster relief in this state. And most of you may be aware that the commission just enacted the bubble, what they call the bubble fisheries on the coast, that allowed for some very small, limited commercial take where we have stocks around certain tributaries that are capable of withstanding some harvest. It's not much, but it's better than nothing at all. And these were designed and can pass the conservation needs test for those stocks that are, we're allowing that on, and without getting into the Klamath River stocks. The other thing we're going to be focusing on and doing some work on and initiating is economic evaluations of our recreation-based, wildlife-based activities, hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching. National level studies show that in Oregon in 2001, that about $2.1 billion is spent annually for hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing. Half of that comes from fishing. About another 50% comes from hunting, and the remainder from wildlife viewing. And that varies back and forth. One of the things that I believe is needed is an understanding of how that distributes itself across the geography of the state relative to how does wildlife-based recreation affect counties. Studies in other states show that one of the best ways to move urban dollars to a rural area is recreation, and wildlife-based recreation is a great way for urban dollars to move into rural economic engines to assist those communities, and we have some tremendous opportunities, but we really don't know what that is, and we need to measure it and make it available to everybody to utilize, and that's relatively straightforward to do. It costs a few dollars and takes about a year, but we're going to get on that and get going with it. I think that's probably enough for me. I'd be stand for questions or give you any further discussion on issues that you have concerns with.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a couple. As you start doing the marine stuff, I think the new research that's being done on the DNA tracking of fish is going to be an important one for us to watch. And the other one, I guess it's really important to me because I'm a big supporter of STEP programs and the education that goes along with STEP. In our area, it has renewed a fishery in a bay that almost didn't have it, and I really attribute that to STEP. So I guess I would invite you to come and see STEP programs and see the things that are happening and talk to the people who are on the ground and the kids that are out there and doing the things and understand that they're really great fish that are produced in our STEP programs. So, thanks.
Great, thank you. Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one thing that I'd be curious is, you know, you talk about this economic evaluation. One of the things I'd be interested in seeing long-term, short-term, is an evaluation of the trends and the barriers that the department faces with respect to both wildlife and fish populations. Some areas of the state, that's my understanding that, for example, the elk populations have gone down so low that the department has had to cut way back on the number of permits tags that it allows. And, you know, you hear from one person that it's bears, you hear from another person that it's cougars, and, you know, for all we know, it could be wolves out there, which, you know, oh my.
Yeah, I knew
yeah, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. But there's other issues involved with this stuff. You know, Nkazi's done a great deal of research on elk populations relative to habitat and forage and the management of forests. And we're all sitting around still waiting, holding our breath to rote and own the Thai chub out of Diamond Lake. And that's a barrier to me. I mean, when we have problems like that that manifest themselves, and we have to go through this lengthy, huge, long process to get to the point where we know we need to be, you know, to deal with the problem. Let's get this stuff in front of the committee and discuss these things. These types of barriers, we need to figure out how we can work on these things and what do we do to kind of move this stuff forward. Because it would seem to me that if we're interested in increasing the numbers of hunters, we need to have something to hunt. And we got to have the tags to go out and do it. And the last thing I'd like to comment on, if I may, is just make note that we've got two confirmed sightings of cougars now in Southeast Bend. So I'm anxious to see how our newly adopted cougar plans do.
That was my question. Representative Dinkelder?
Thank you, and welcome to Oregon, where I was just cycling in your old state earlier this month and saw one of the biggest bull mooses I've ever seen right off the side of the road. So it was very exciting. But a couple, I just wanted to make a comment on one of the issues that you raised, and I learned a lot about this sitting in Representative Morgan's committee last session as we reviewed ODF&W's budget about the decline in hunting and fishing tags for a number of reasons, and Representative Burley had mentioned one of them. But I know you're already looking into this, but really encourage you to look at ways that we can be creative in funding our conservation and wildlife programs through passive recreation. And we do know that that is one of the fastest growing aspects of the recreation element in Oregon. You already mentioned wildlife viewing. I happen to represent a district that's very near, actually I think it's in Representative Witt's district, Saubes Island, which is
right.
One of the, I think it's the only place where you actually charge for people to do passive viewing. Is that correct in the state? Is Saubes Island unit. And looking at how we can replicate that model around the state, because I do know it's hugely popular, and that is one way to, as you already mentioned, capitalize on a growing urban and suburban population that's demanding access to these resources. So I'm sure you'll be looking at that, coming back to the Ways and Means Committee and talking about that next session. But I think that is a huge untapped resource that we really need to explore. And I'd be curious to hear about how other states are doing it and how it was handled in Idaho. I'm sure other states throughout the West are probably facing similar challenges, and certainly be interested to hear your views on that.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can talk more specifically, but in general, the concept of user pay, user benefit is how most fish and wildlife agencies in the United States have functioned. Mm. There are a few states, very few, that have figured out how to get a permanent inflation-proof funding base for wildlife-based management that spans all of the population, not just the hunters and fishermen. I believe personally that Oregon is well situated to take that on because of the long history they have with dedicating funds to conservation and fish and wildlife management, whether it be the lottery funds that are so important, the STEP programs that were discussed. There's a rich history of that, and I think there's solutions to that. The Savi Island example, and Ron may need to help me here, there is a charge for folks who don't have a hunting or fishing license. And again, that recognizes that those wildlife management areas were predominantly bought, purchased, and managed with the sportsman's dollars, the hunting and fishing dollars, and that those who do not have not paid have need to pay to benefit. The administration of those, Savi Island's unique, it's close enough, it can handle that. Smaller, more remote areas where taking fees in becomes a greater staff burden than the benefit it accrues becomes a difficulty. Some states have used conservation stamps that can be purchased that are not part of the hunting and fishing license but add to it. There's any number of items out there, but you're absolutely right. It is an area we need to, particularly in urban expansion areas where you have this wildlife interface and the desires by the public to use those open spaces that are dedicated to wildlife management comes into play. And creative management needs, working with the local folks, are going to be needed.
I would suggest maybe we could look at the Cougars and Bend chart.
I look forward to working with you on that. Right.
And Madam Chair, contrary to popular belief, I did not bring wolves with me in my meeting. The director in Idaho has a standing offer that he will ship as many and to you from any place to any place.
We don't need that.
but I was checked at the border and I came through clean.
Representative Shaffer?
Thank you. This came to my attention when I was watching Oregon Field Guide on PBS one night, and they were cleaning up. It was all about, I think it was Oregon Field Guide. It was all about your game wardens that float down the river in eastern Oregon. I think it was Snake River. They pointed out the fact that because they're also a state police officer, we were getting two for one. They're arresting criminals, dopers, God knows what out there. And I'm of the opinion that I think that's a good idea and I should stay that way. There are people here that I have great respect for that question whether or not we should do that, whether they should be strictly game and not state police. You want to just comment on that? Or have you any opinion yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I hope I got that name right.
You're doing good, yeah.
Oregon's model works very well. Mm-hmm. I have no visions of recommending any changes in that model. What you pointed out is one of the benefits. Other states, most of the western states, follow the model of the enforcement function being part of the Fish and Wildlife Management agencies and predominantly hiring fish and wildlife professionals and then giving them the peace officer standard training. What they find in most of the western states, and this comes from the Conservation Officers Association, which is the professional society, is they typically spend about half their time on directed wildlife law enforcement. OSP surveys show their officers spend about half of their time on directed wildlife enforcement. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife funds just a little over, I believe, half of the cost of the wildlife law enforcement program, the remaining cost coming from federal grants and or general funds at this point in time. The difference is that in the states where the conservation officers are part of the fish and wildlife program, their other half of time is typically spent assisting in the biological management functions of the agency, only doing primary public safety enforcement when requested by sheriffs or state police or other entities. Whereas in Oregon, that extra time is predominantly used on public safety law enforcement. So there's no right or wrong model here. It's just one that Oregon has chosen. It's working well for us. We have good working relationships with OSP, and I have no reason to believe that that model shouldn't continue. I do believe we need more funding for wildlife enforcement. I would like to see the funding from the department increase sufficiently to buy more of their time to do directed wildlife law enforcement activities and to provide them with better and more modern equipment, And you'll be hearing us have some discussions about how we should proceed with doing that.
Great. Great question. Representative Witt?
A couple of suggestions here for additional recruitment folks into hunting and fishing. I think one of the greatest things that we could do, particularly for folks who may be considering either one of these sports, is to simplify our hunting and fishing synopses. Those are intimidating booklets.
It is. Yes, they are.
They are. I can never find it.
Another suggestion, maybe a three-species sporting license. The purchaser could pick the three species that he or she wanted to take. And a true all-species sporting license. It's currently not doesn't cover shellfish. And for those of us who want one license and you're good to go, I think that that would be very helpful. I think that the current level of non-resident fees is a disincentive for those folks to want to come to our state. Of course, that's a policy consideration, whether we want to recruit non-residents. And lastly, for those of us who enjoy the non-motorized hunting opportunity through cooperative land management, I've noticed a good deal of slippage here lately. It's non-motorized for elk season, but it's motorized in deer season. And frankly, there are a lot of us that want that non-motorized opportunity and a true non-motorized opportunity. I think there's a potential there of recruiting a significant number of folks.
Are you suggesting certain areas be...
Certain areas, yeah. Yeah. And in the areas that we've already...
That's a good idea.
That we've already experimented with.
Thank you. Any comments? Or?
No. I don't know whether, Ron, you need to follow up on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you again. A couple of things. Yes, we do have some road closures where they are not in effect during archery season and in some cases not during deer season. We can look at are there ways to bring those on board. There are challenges for us with the Forest Service anymore and the levels of funding that they have relative to implementation of those closures and the administration of them. So we'll have to work through those on a case-by-case basis, but there are some opportunities there. A couple of comments based on some of the questions and statements that you've made. The non-resident fees that we have today in Oregon do not appear to be a detriment to non-residents hunting within the state. The analysis that we have done has shown a dramatic increase in non-residents hunting in Oregon and a fairly major climb over the last 10 years. So when we do fee increases and look at that, we take that into account in looking at what other states charge, and we're somewhere right in the middle of the pack as far as others go. We also, this spring, completed a hunter recruitment group that looked at specifically what are the barriers to recruiting people into the agency and participating within the sport. And youth hunting opportunities were stressed as something that they wanted to see us increase, maintain, and increase where possible. Looking at the mentored hunting program, as the director stated, and simplification of the regulations was one of the big things, and we recognize that it is very complex, and we'll be looking to continue to meet with this group. They wanted us to form them as a standing committee and looking at maybe an east side and a west side committee, because it is a long ways to get people to travel in this day and age, that we would go to them instead and look for ways that we can work with them to increase opportunities and to simplify regulations. And also, as Virgil alluded to, the lapsed hunters, people that used to hunt here or fish here and no longer do, contacting those individuals to find out, why don't you participate anymore? And there's been some studies that, at least on the fish side, that there's been some directed marketing
towards those people, and that for every dollar that they spend in marketing trying to draw those people back into the sport, that it's been a return of $3 for every dollar spent. So that's a pretty good return, and we're just kind of coming on to the early stages of that, and it ties in with what Virgil was talking about and looking for ways that we can tap into that and tap into that with the sporting goods industry, because they also have a directed interest in it and have been willing to work with us, and we're participating in this retention group in finding ways that they can help us in doing that marketing.
Great. Thank you.
A couple of things, if I may. First of all, I agree with Representative Wood about the regulations. I mean, you know, and the department may have good reasons, but when you take a stream and in the course of 5 or 6 miles of that stream, you've got 3 to 8 different sets of regulations based on whether you're above Bridge 99 or below these falls. Hell, people don't know where this stuff is when they come from out of town, and it really is very confusing. Couple things real quickly, from last year. LOP tags are, if I'm not mistaken, isn't that due to sunset sometime in the not too distant future? And if so, you know, what is being done about that? Landowner preference tags. And in conjunction with that, of course, is the whole access issue. And then the other thing, too, that was kind of popping up on some radar screens last year was the concept of weapon of choice for hunting. And I'm a little curious if that still has some legs or where that's going or where it went.
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Ron handle those. Some of them I've been slightly briefed on, others I don't. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the landowner preference bill that is up for sunset in the near future is the Southwest Oregon Damage Pilot Program that we've had out there. The actual landowner preference program itself is not up for sunset. And actually, we've introduced a legislative concept because the sunset for the Southwest Damage Project kind of falls in between sessions and in the middle of the year, and really did not allow us to offer good service delivery to the landowners that were participating in the program and fully evaluate it before we came back to the legislature to ask for formalization of bringing that into the agency. So that is a legislative concept that we'll hopefully have in front of you this next spring on extending of the pilot program in Southwest Oregon. The weapon of choice of hunting, that's something that's come up quite a bit from the archery community in particular, and the agency at this point in time does not have any real plans on taking anything like that forward, but it is something that is part of the hunter recruitment group that we certainly would look at and have further discussions with.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I think the only thing I want an update is where are we at on the cougar plan? Do we know? You knew I'd ask.
Madam Chair, as you're well aware, cougars are a big issue in the state. I've done 2 radio interviews on the recent sightings in Bend, and just completed one again this morning with K-Bend Radio. The commission adopted the new cougar management plan this last April. The plan was a fairly radical change from our previous plan from 1993, and what it was, what it revolved around was the commission making a policy decision on how they wanted us as an agency to deal with conflict that cougars cause at a variety of levels. And the commission decided that they wanted us to move forward with plans to administratively remove cougars from areas of high conflict. That's what the plan calls for. And it still utilizes hunters in a proactive manner to go out and try and reduce populations in areas that we want those populations reduced. But it recognizes that hunting as we know it today without the use of dogs has not been very effective at controlling cougar populations and solving conflict problems. So the plan as adopted allows the department to establish what we call target areas where we have a history of conflict, whether it's damage conflict, whether it's human safety pet conflict, or whether it's big game conflict where we're not seeing recruitment, to identify these target areas based on the history that we already have in place, and then to utilize either our own employees or, once Wildlife Services has completed a NEPA process, to utilize Wildlife Services to go in and remove cougars. For this first year, we've selected three target areas. One is in Jackson County to deal with human safety and pets and livestock. One is in the Heppner area to deal with the big game issues and recruitment for elk. And the other is over out of Ontario to deal specifically with loss of livestock, where we have a history of that. There were a total of 14 areas proposed by the regions. And we made the decision that for this first year, knowing that we have some bugs we'll have to work out of the system, if you will, that we were going to take a conservative approach in the target area implementation and select one target area to coincide for each one of the three main objectives within the plan. That left some areas out, like the Bend area, once we made our final decisions. But it was based on, you know, the level of conflict we've had over a prolonged period of time. And it still allows us to go in a reactive mode and do normal removal of cougars that are causing problems, but does not, in a broad base manner at this point in time, we're not implementing in every portion of the state.
Right. Thank you. Yes, Representative.
You know, I want cougars to thrive, bears, even wolves. But, you know, we got a market out there that's just chomping at the bit to go out for a cougar hunt if we let them use their dogs. For the life of me, why we would want to use, you know, fish and wildlife money when we ain't got any money, when there's a bunch of folks that go out there and do it gladly,
we'll pay to
for
do
us, even pay to do it. You know, this doesn't make any sense to me, and I'm editorializing here and voicing my own opinion, but I think, and there's a lot of folks that agree with me, we should let the hunters take care of this problem for us. And that, as my good friend here said, they'll pay to do it. And we don't have to administratively do it and use our limited resources that can go somewhere else more productively. There's people right in this room that will go out and pay for it. So that's something I think that just makes sense, that, you know, you're looking for efficiency, would you run your business this way kind of attitude. I urge you to go look in that direction, and just, I know it's controversial, but so what? That's what we're here for, right? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Birdie wants to make it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. But, I have to tell you, I'm very concerned about the reactive mode on this cougar issue. Because when I, you know, the first time, and I know people always say, well, we haven't had any attacks on humans in the state of Oregon yet. And when that first one occurs in the city of Bend, I'm not going to be happy. And we've got a history of cougars in that city already, and it goes back many years to when that, you know, I keep telling the story about the woman that woke up and the thing was bedded down in her flower garden, and she lived two blocks from a middle school. And I think we need to start getting more aggressive on these things and deal with this problem, because it's going to happen. It's inevitable. So, you know, I have all the sympathy in the world for crop damage and livestock damage and all that, but to me, it's the human life that concerns me. And these things are in the city of Bend. They're sleeping under people's decks. I mean, it's like this throughout the state. Grant County, you go out there and talk to those folks, they don't let their kids go to the school bus stop by themselves anymore, because these cougars are all over the place. So,
thank you.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm a bandwagon.
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, we share your concerns. We really do. And the last thing we want is any kind of a mauling by any wildlife. And we recognize that cougars are a huge concern to a lot of people. This plan will get us there. Like I said, the first year, our intent was to be a little bit conservative, to work some of the bugs out, and then to move forward with a more full implementation of the plan in the years to come. We do have some concerns on how we fully fund it. Recognize Representative Schaffler, your comments, that is the model that we used to employ. And with the passage of Measure 18 and the law that laid down, it ties our hands. And we've looked at the law, we've looked at what we're allowed to do, and we are operating within the full scope of the law with what the plan will allow us to do. And the last thing we want is anybody to be hurt, and we will do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
May I clarify, I'm not blaming you guys or Fish and Wildlife.
He's used to it.
We need to change the law is what we need to do, and that's all there is to it. Before, and I just hope it ain't, I hope it's not a child, I hope it's some jerk, you know, that this happens. that way we'll kill two birds with one stone. But, you know,
I can't believe he said that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Well, since we're beating the dead horse here,
yeah.
One thing, and I certainly know we have some challenges, and certainly appreciate you, both of you, taking it on, but also with Measure 37, one of the concerns I have is the encroachment upon traditional wildlife habitat areas that we don't really talk about. I mean, I work as a planner in my daily job every day. I talk to people who are interested in developing land or building something, and we really don't talk about part of why we have these problems is because we are encroaching. Bend is a classic example where we're growing leaps and bounds on traditional habitat areas, and so I think we need to just here for a little balance, make sure that on the record we have to continue to be vigilant in we're going to have, I think, greater threats upon development on habitat areas in the state. And so, if anything, this is probably going to become more of an issue. And I think it's important that we recognize, though, we do have land use planning and certain restrictions in place to try to minimize these conflicts in the beginning. And same thing with fire hazards. Right. I mean, certainly we look at all the increase in fire hazards on homes that are built in the fringe areas, and there's a lot of issues, I think, that we're going to see escalated because of these increased development pressures.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great to meet you, and thank you for coming before us. I'm sure you'll be back before us.
I'm sure
many
we will.
Times. Welcome to Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to Oregon.
Welcome to Oregon.
I like your one fish, two fish.
Yeah.
Dr. Seuss.
Is there any other business that the committee needs to take up? I'll see you September 8th for our field trip. Thank you very much. With that, we're adjourned.
That's cool.
Okay. Folks.